Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Trump's escalation of his war on the press he calls the enemy of the people, a description he tweeted out on Wednesday in caps, attacking the New York Times. Today he attacked the Washington Post in support of Nick Sandman, a high school senior in Washington, D.C., for an anti-abortion rally seen in a video that went viral, wearing a MAGA hat, smirking in the face of a Native American elder. Trump tweeted, "Go get them, Nick. Fake news." James Wheaton, who teaches First Amendment law and journalism law at both UC Berkeley and Stanford University's Graduate Schools of Communications, joins us to discuss the coincidences that Trump is championing a $250 million lawsuit against the Post for the exact amount his nemesis Jeff Bezos paid for the newspaper. And we'll assess the coincidence that Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas announced the Supreme Court should reconsider its 1964 landmark First Amendment ruling in New York Times versus Sullivan shortly after his wife's Oval Office visit with Trump, who has repeatedly called for an overhaul of America's libel law, vowing, quote, "I'm going to open up our libel laws so when they write purposefully negative and horrible and false articles, we can sue them and win lots of money." Then we'll examine the hidden history of American empire, which flies in the face of our cherished foundation as a country forged in an anti-colonial revolution and instilled with the popular belief we are a world power spreading freedom and democracy, having saved the world twice with our reluctant interventions in World War I and World War II. Historian Daniel Immerwahr, a professor of history at Northwestern University, joins us to discuss his new book just out, How to Hide an Empire, A History of the Greater United States. And he shatters myths as the American Republic and shatter the myths as the American Republic continues its struggle to survive the American empire. Then finally, we will look into why suddenly the Mueller report is about to be released following Acting Attorney General Whitaker's recent hint it was close to being finished, and then the recent arrival of a new Attorney General who auditioned for Trump and got the job because he was critical of the Mueller probe. Jeremy Vanuk, a research analyst for the Moscow Project at the Center for American Progress, who previously was an editorial fellow at The Atlantic, joins us to discuss whether there is a move underway to protect the Republican Party from the damage a revelation of the extent of Trump's criminality and treason would inflict on the GOP. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is James Wheaton, who has litigated at all levels of the state and federal courts in cases involving civil rights, consumer rights, environmental, and First Amendment law. He was a researcher for Ralph Nader's Center for the Study for Responsive Law and is currently teaches journalism law at both UC Berkeley and Stanford University's Graduate Schools of Communications. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Wheaton.
Thank you so much.
And Trump has been piling on. We know he's been attacking the press for the longest time, but he just on Wednesday tweeted out his refrain, the enemy of the people, in caps, attacking the New York Times. And today he attacked the Washington Post in support of Nick Sandman, the high school senior who was in Washington, D.C. for an anti-abortion rally. And he was seen in a video that went viral wearing a Make America Great Again hat, smirking in the face of a Native American elder. And Trump tweeted out, "Go get them, Nick. Fake news." So there's many more examples, but let's start with those. Is there some coordination going on here, attacking the New York Times, attacking the Washington Post, meeting with the wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, and then shortly thereafter, Clarence Thomas saying that the Supreme Court should reconsider its 1964 landmark First Amendment ruling in New York Times versus Sullivan?
One can try to connect the dots here between what Mr. Trump has been tweeting and what Justice Thomas did recently in a case suggesting we roll the clock back on libel law about 230 years. But I don't think we need to do that because Trump has been fulminating about unfavorable press coverage even since before he became president. The only kind of press coverage he accepts as legitimate is, you know, fawning and flattery. His tweets, to be quite honest, I think we'd all be better off if we spent less time paying attention to his tweets, which, in the words of Shakespeare, is just a tale told by a fool full of sound and fury but signifying nothing. The president has no role whatsoever in libel law, so he can fulminate all he wishes, but it doesn't mean anything. It is dangerous for the president to be calling out specific publications and even specific journalists for his anger, because there are people out there who listen to that and might react. The recent story suggesting that there was a Coast Guard who was stockpiling weapons to go after Trump's enemies is, I should be a great concern to everyone. With regard to Justice Thomas, where to start? He wrote an opinion suggesting that all of the law regarding libel, not just New York Times versus Sullivan, that was written more than 50 years ago. The Supreme Court, by the way, is not in the business of overturning precedents that are 50 or more years old. But he wants to wind the clock all the way back to 1790 and restore the law. And just for the listeners to understand what that means he wants the court to revive a doctrine of criminal libel. That is, any criticism of a public official that causes any kind of unrest is a crime, and truth is no defense. I'm not making that up. He wrote that in an opinion. In other words, he wants to take us back to the days when we had the Sedition Act, where any criticism of the president or of Congress was a crime. And President Adams actually put editors and newspapers in jail for doing so. That's beyond the pale of embarrassing, to be honest, to even write things like that.
But it also feels un-American in terms of the revolution. The revolutionaries, Washington and Jefferson, etc., they absolutely chafed under the British libel laws. The very laws, by the way, which they still have in Britain today and in Australia and other countries. That's why Tom Paine became a pamphleteer. He couldn't get any of this criticism of the Mad King George printed, and they had these draconian laws that would put them away forever in jail, and that's the very laws that Thomas is talking about reviving. I mean, is he some kind of Tory? What's going on here?
It's almost embarrassing. You want to just look away for Justice Thomas to essentially completely forget our history, and as you so eloquently put it, that the part of the reason for the revolution and throwing off the British yoke was precisely because they were not allowed to criticize the king. The Declaration of Independence was a revolutionary document, not just because it declared independence by a colony against an empire, but because it actually criticized the king by name, and that was not done. We today, in 2019, in the United States, enjoy a nearly unfettered right to criticize those in public office. In the words of the Supreme Court, our debate is caustic and wide open, and so it should be. And Justice Thomas somehow wants to take it back. But let us remember that Justice Thomas, in his confirmation hearings, it was far worse than what Mr. Kavanaugh recently went through, because it was an actual employee citing chapter and verse of what Thomas did to her to harass her. And he is angry to this day about it, and so he does not support a vigorous, free press. Neither does Mr. Trump. He seems to chafe and does not like a vigorous and free press. But the good news is neither of them is going to be able to do anything about it. Justice Thomas spoke only for himself. None of the other justices joined that opinion, and none of them will.
And again, I'm speaking with James Wheaton, who has litigated at all levels of the state and federal courts in cases involving civil rights, consumer rights, environmental and First Amendment law. He was a researcher for Ralph Nader's Center for the Study of Responsive Law and is currently teaching journalism law at both UC Berkeley and Stanford University's graduate schools for communications. Well, Donald Trump has gone on the record vowing, I'm going to open up our libel laws so when they write purposefully negative and horrible and false articles, we can sue them and win lots of money. That's, I guess, the only virtue of Donald Trump is that he's not shy about voicing his horrible, sinister, reactionary, and destructive thoughts. You would think that he might be a little covert about it, but no, he's out there in front.
Yeah, well, he clearly has no filter. But I think the funny thing is, and I believe he was later quoted as having been schooled by somebody with a little more knowledge about these matters than he has, that actually the first person who would get sued if we, quote, opened up the libel laws would be Mr. Trump himself, who posts lies on a regular basis about other people. The person who most needs the protection of the libel laws, quite honestly, is Trump himself. So, right. Again, the president has no role whatsoever in setting libel law, in hearing libel cases. He just has no role. So he's really just sitting on the sidelines fulminating, and it doesn't mean anything.
I guess, the first people that would be suing him would be all of the Republicans he ran against in the primary, right?
All of them. You could think it. Yeah, right. Other candidates. Well, yeah. Heavens, why wouldn't the New York Times or the Washington Post
right.
sue him?
Yeah.
He calls them failing and so forth.
Exactly.
Fake news,
That's true.
He does it,
They are businesses. That's not good for business. They'd actually have a case, wouldn't they?
They might. They might. There is something called trade libel when you libel a product.
Right. So how much, though, are the American people, you think, recognizing the extraordinarily valuable nature of the First Amendment and the protections that the Founding Fathers gave us simply because of how difficult it was for them to bring about the American Revolution under the yoke of the Mad King and his libel laws, which, again, as I mentioned, James, still exist in the UK. That's why Trump and his wife actually went to, his wife sued the Daily Mail in the courts because they can get a victory under the reactionary libel laws that still exist today. And I have a brother in Australia who's an investigative journalist, and he exposed an Australian war hero as a war criminal. And both Rupert Murdoch and another Australian press oligarch are suing him for personal damages, along with the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. And if they were to win, he would lose everything, his house, everything. So those laws still exist. And we are so lucky here to have the First Amendment. I just don't know that the average American understands how valuable and important it is.
It's funny, and I've been doing this now for over a quarter century, and it's always fascinated me that the American public's simultaneous reverence for the Constitution, and particularly for the First Amendment and the freedom of speech that we enjoy, unparalleled almost in the world, with their simultaneous dislike of newspapers and news organizations who operate under that. It's like we love the law, but hate what people do with it. It's so funny. But I can tell you that in the cases that I've done, and I've done them for every manner of person in every walk of life, there is universal reverence for free speech and the First Amendment. And while we may dislike the newspapers, we don't want anybody tinkering with that or limiting those freedoms at all.
So what do you think, then, is the chances of anybody on that court taking Justice Thomas's ideas any further? I mean, what can he do as a Supreme Court justice who has already said that the foundation of modern libel laws in the United States, New York Times versus Sullivan, should be revisited, if not overturned?
Yeah, Justice Thomas, he stands alone on this perspective. No other justice in the last 50 years has expressed any views even remotely similar. His brethren in the jurisprudence, was Justice Scalia, and even Justice Scalia never suggested that they should undo the New York Times versus Sullivan decision protecting newspapers, in fact, protecting everyone's right to speak freely about public officials. Justice Thomas has a, unique view of the law, and he wants to wind the clock back on everything back to 1790, as if the last 230 years never happened. He lives alone with that. No other serious judicial scholar shares his views that basically the clock stopped in 1790 and you know, all of modernity never happened.
Right, and the British libel laws, which we've been talking about, which still afflict, as I say, afflict yes. my own brother at the behest of Murdoch, you know, who basically he runs the Pravda of the Republican Party, Fox News. He's a propagandist.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he's throwing his weight around. But the British libel laws, they go as far back as the 13th century, don't they?
I don't know a great deal about British law, so I shouldn't probably opine about that, other than the general knowledge that people who want to sue for a little internationally always prefer any of the Commonwealth countries to file their cases precisely so they can avoid the protections of the First Amendment.
Right. Well, again, it's a puzzle why we don't celebrate it more. I guess people just don't like journalists. Is that what it is? You teach journalism. What is it?
I'm
assuming it's...
You know who else they dislike besides journalists? People don't like lawyers.
Right.
And lawyer teaching journalists. Oh, my God.
Oh, you've got double jeopardy. Yeah, but they also don't like politicians. I think they lump politicians and journalists together at the sort of bottom of the barrel. I wonder if it has something to do with every time you get quoted in the press, no matter who you are, it never feels right. Is that what it is?
No. I think it's much more that – and if you go out and you ask people, you know, do you like news, they're going to think of the ones they dislike first. But if you pin them down and then ask them what they do like, oddly enough, what the news that the American public likes the best is local television.
Hmm. And that's why if they get their information from that, then we are truly in trouble, because all it is about car accidents and horrible incidents, making you feel like the whole country's under siege.
But on the other hand, you know, the consumers of news, it's a face, it's a familiar face, it's a local face, it feels like one of us. Whereas the large newspapers, the networks and so forth, the cable news, those are people far, far away. They're not one of us. And so people don't identify with them. And newspapers, of course, you have a byline, and so it's faceless. And so people don't identify, and they distrust it a little bit more, I think. That being said, where do people turn when there's a natural disaster? Where do people turn to find out about what's going on in the world? Where do people turn to find out what, you know, what's going on in an election? They turn to their national news. So we hate it, but we use it.
Well, that's why Rupert Murdoch is busily trying to buy up more and more television stations in swing states.
Yes, he is. Yeah. And
they make a fortune.
There is a disturbing trend of monopolization, yes.
Yeah, but they make a fortune for out of our dysfunctional electoral system, where what we have is a bunch of representatives in the Congress who spend their days dialing for dollars. They're actually telemarketers, not representatives. And then they turn that money over to the Murdochs of the world in order to get reelected.
The arms race that's been going on in campaign spending, much of it driven by the need to purchase television time and television ads, is shameful.
Right.
But every effort, unfortunately, to try to clean that up keeps running into a very conservative Supreme Court, which thinks that speech is the same as money.
Yeah, no, I saw a softball interview that Scalia did with that unctuous British journalist, Piers Morgan, who gave him all these softball questions. But I recall Justice Scalia saying, there's no way of getting around it. Money equals speech. At which point I kept thinking, well, can't you challenge that? I mean, where in God's name did that idea come from? And why is it chiseled in stone?
It is one of the most unfortunate doctrines that this Supreme Court, a previous Supreme Court, ever adopted, the notion that money is the same as speech. It overturned almost 100 years of that said, no, money is not the same as speech, and we cannot allow money to so flood our campaigns that only the rich are really participating in deciding who candidates are and which candidates are viable and so forth. That limitations on money on campaigns is absolutely necessary. And I know that I'm going to part ways with some of my First Amendment friends who do think that campaign spending is the same as speech, but I couldn't disagree more.
And just in closing, it is connected to the libel laws, isn't it? It's all about, in the case of the campaign spending, it's enabling the rich and powerful to buy our politics. And in the case of trying to change the libel laws, it would enable the rich and powerful to be immune from criticism.
the rich and powerful have always been able to manipulate the legal system to their advantage. Indeed, this is such a systemic problem that we have our very symbols of law recognize this. That's why justice, the Lady Justice, is blind. What she's blinded to is money and power. So that the scales of justice are equal. They chiseled it into the wall over the entrance to the Supreme Court. It says equal justice under law. And the equality was meant to deal with the problem of the rich and the poor, and that everybody's entitled to their day in justice. So this problem has always been with us, and it always will be with us. And every now and again, we get a Supreme Court that screws it up, as this one has. And I hope at some point, rather than overturning New York Times versus Sullivan and the protection of libel laws, let's overturn the silly doctrine that money is the same as speech.
Well, James Wheaton, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Oh, you're very welcome, and thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with James Wheaton, who has litigated at all levels of the state and federal courts in cases involving civil rights, consumer rights, environmental, and First Amendment law. And he was a researcher for Ralph Nader's Center of the Study for Responsive Law and is currently teaching journalism law at both UC Berkeley and Stanford University's Graduate Schools of Communications. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the hidden history of the American empire.
Parting of the flux from the shadow of an empire. God loves a trier, an articulate liar.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Daniel Immerwahr, who is a professor of history at Northwestern University and the author of Thinking Small, The United States and the Lure of Community Development. He's written for Slate and Dissent, among other publications, and his latest book just out is How to Hide an Empire, A History of the Greater United States. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniel Immerwahr.
Good to be here.
And the United States, of course, is all if, it got its independence from a colonial power, the King of Britain, the Mad King, and it's never had this reputation of being a colonial power. But as you pointed out in your book, it sort of happened in a stealth way. And I guess at the end of the day, the question would be, will the American Republic survive the American Empire?
Yeah, so it's a funny tension between the two, the republic and the empire. The country thinks of itself very much as a republic, thinking of its history of independence from Britain. And a lot of our national mythology, including some of our favorite films like Star Wars, are all about rebellion from empires. So this is a really important part of national culture here in the United States. But it's not a very good portrait of the country itself. So from day one, from the first day when the United States got its independence from Britain until today and every intervening day between, it's been not, as the title suggests, a union of states, but it's been a collection of states and territories. It's had territories from the first day, and it has territories today. Now some 4 million people live in them. And can the republic survive the empire? I don't know, but I think a lot of the crises that are facing the United States face it and have faced it, particularly in the overseas territories.
But in addition to this, would you count the, 187 countries that the U.S. military has bases in?
Yeah, so that's a really important thing to recognize about the territorial extension of the United States. On the one hand, it has overseas territories, so colonies along the familiar model. On the other hand, the United States also owns or has access to and has funded 800 or so military bases in foreign countries. So if you look at the United States sort of in your mind's eye, you often just see, you know, the familiar shape bounded by Canada and Mexico and the oceans. But if you actually consider all the parts on the planet over which the United States has jurisdiction, I mean, you're looking at just a map dotted with flags. And those military bases are both important for, you know, for the military to project force. But they're also a really important form of politics, and a lot of global history has happened around them or in reaction to them.
Well, having grown up in Australia, of course, we would always see the maps in our schoolrooms when we were taught geography, the maps of the British Empire upon which the sun didn't set, with all of these areas around the world in usually in red or pink. And they were proud of that, except now it's somewhat reduced and the British Commonwealth is not quite the same as the British Empire. But that's not happening here in our schools, is it?
No, but there was an incredible moment right after 1898 when the United States, in a sort of imperial shopping spree, suddenly acquired the Philippines, Guam, Puerto Rico, Hawaii, and American Samoa, and an occupied Cuba. And there was a moment when cartographers in the United States suddenly felt that their country looked different. And they wanted to show it as looking different. So they produced these maps that show the United States, as you often think of it familiarly, that just contiguous blob. But then they showed it surrounded by boxes. So you'd see the Philippines, you'd see Guam, you'd see Puerto Rico. And this was something that you can find in textbooks, often on the inside cover of a textbook, would be the portrait of the United States, and that's what it would look like. That moment of cartographic enthusiasm for empire didn't last very long. It lasted a decade or so. But you could see a moment when the United States is flirting with a new identity, not just that it has an empire, which it indisputably does, but that it's identifying itself like Britain as a sort of, you know, up-and-comer in the imperial club.
Well, that was during the Teddy Roosevelt's Great White Fleet days, wasn't it?
And that's right, yeah.
And we think of him in retrospect as a trust buster and a very virtuous Republican, but he certainly was an imperialist.
Teddy Roosevelt was a forthright imperialist, and he was an imperialist in two senses. One is his great enthusiasm for westward expansion over the North American continent, which he understood not just to mean the growth and expansion of white settlers, but the dislodging of indigenous peoples. He was very explicit about understanding that to be part of the project and accepting that as part of the project. And then he was also, once he felt that the United States had run out of land in the North American continent, he was eager for more and was an enthusiastic proponent and in some ways an important architect of the United States' war with Spain, which led to that imperial shopping spree. That was something he was deeply enthusiastic about, and his enthusiasm only started waning after the Philippine War, which the United States undertook to subdue the Philippines and to pacify it against Philippine nationalists. That was a war that killed more people, we think, than the U.S. Civil War. It was only after that that it seems like Teddy Roosevelt's imperial enthusiasm waned a little bit.
Well, what do you think is the lesson here in the sense that it still seems that we have vestiges of a colonial attitude towards, I mean, take the case of Puerto Rico. I mean, and we do have an aberrant president who seems the most ill-prepared president we've ever had. So with that caveat in mind, he nevertheless showed a kind of racist disdain for the Puerto Ricans who were suffering terribly after this two hurricanes struck them. And he tossed a bunch of paper towels at these people, literally, in a kind of Marie Antoinette way. And the way they lied about the number of casualties and were completely indifferent to the suffering with a lackadaisical attitude to bringing aid. And now there's even talk that the Trump administration may take some of that money away for Puerto Rico in order to build his wall on the southern border. So with that, you know, caveat in mind, do you think this kind of colonial attitude still exists in the American mindset vis-a-vis its territories like Puerto Rico?
Yeah, it's really stark the way that Trump has treated and reacted to Puerto Rico. And it's not just things like seeking to raid money that is earmarked for Puerto Rico to build his wall. He's opposed the extension of other funds to Puerto Rico, nutrition assistance funds, but also just the way that he refers to Puerto Rico. He has this noticeable habit of addressing the island in the second person. So he says things like this, I hate to tell you, Puerto Rico, but you've thrown our budget out of whack. And if you just attend to the pronouns you and are, you have a real clear sense of who the us is for Trump and who the them is, where the here is, where the there is. And, you know, that's lamentable, and it carries real and lethal consequences for Puerto Rico and threatens them for other territories as well. But I'm not sure how aberrant it is, that sense that there are parts of the United States that count, that matter, and there are other parts of the United States that don't. I mean, that's baked into 20th century and 21st century history. Woodrow Wilson had a similar way of saying it when he, you know, said of the territories that they lay outside the charmed circle of our national life. I don't see that much of a difference, except the level of crudeness, between that sentiment expressed by one of the most idealistic presidents, Woodrow Wilson, and the same sentiment expressed by perhaps one of our least ones, Donald Trump.
And again, I'm speaking with Daniel Immerwahr, who is a professor of history at Northwestern University and the author of Thinking Small, The United States and the Lure of Community Development. He has written for Slate and Dissent, among other publications, and his latest book just out is How to Hide an Empire, A History of the Greater United States. So the other reputation that the U.S. has is not just not being a colonial power, but also being the kind of power that had to intervene twice to deal with, particularly in the case of World War I, to deal with the folly of the Imperial British powers getting into a hideous war that just killed people, young men, in wholesale, in massive droves. And it was essentially an argument amongst the same royal family, between the German branch and the British branch of the same royal family. So that was the reputation of Wilson and others, and of course he started the League of Nations, was the idea that the U.S. was the non-colonial power that was reluctantly having to be the kind of adult to sort out the mess. But one of the things that I had read recently, and I'd like to get your take on this, was that one of the reasons that the U.S. joined in World War I was that they had been financing the Brits and the French, I guess, to some extent. And then when the Germans sent Lenin in a boxcar to the Soviet Union and the whole Eastern Front collapsed, and then the Germans sent 50 divisions to the Western Front, the choice was, you know, do we let Germany win the war, in which case we'll never get our money back? I mean, I know it's a cynical version, but I'm wondering about whether or not the intervention in World War I was so altruistic, whether it was really about saving civilization or making sure that you got repaid the loans that you put out to the Brits.
Well, there's two things I can speak about. One is this notion that was certainly held at the time, not only throughout the European world, but also to a large degree throughout the colonized world, that the United States was, as you put it, aloof from empire, that it was above such things. And it's true that the United States cultivated that image, but during World War I, under Woodrow Wilson, the United States claimed a new colony, the U.S. Virgin Islands. It didn't decolonize it. It grew its empire such that, you know, by the interwar period, it had the world's fifth largest empire on the planet. Not quite the size of the British Empire, but nevertheless, a really substantial empire with millions of people in it. So as to Woodrow Wilson's motivations, he had initially opposed the war, or opposed the U.S. Entry into the war, and campaigned and won on that platform. But it's absolutely true that Woodrow Wilson, in part, entered the war, you know, not of a sort of desire for revenge or a desire to protect the territorial integrity of the United States, which are reasons why people often entered wars, but as a desire to insert the United States as the central and decisive power into determining the post-war international order, financial, yes, but political as well.
And after World War II, the U.S. was the last man standing. And again, the Brits, during World War I, they had to liquidate so much of their holdings here in the United States to pay for U.S.'s aid and armaments, etc. But in World War II, they really did pay, you know, not to suggest that in any way the U.S. joining World War II, which happened because of the Japanese invasion, but for the fact that Hitler was a lunatic and he decided to declare war on the United States, it's not entirely clear, is it, that the United States would have joined the war against Germany?
Yeah, I mean, historians have debated that. I want to address the thing you said, that the United States was the last man standing. I think we often have the sense that the United States was, except for that one brief attack at Pearl Harbor, unscathed and uniquely unscathed during the war, whereas all of its rivals and indeed its allies were laid waste during the war. That's not quite right, and the reason it's not quite right is that that story only really makes sense if you understand the United States to be that contiguous blob bounded by Canada, Mexico, and the oceans. Once you understand that the United States actually has much more extensive territorial holdings, you realize that World War II for the United States was fought on U.S. soil. The Japanese not only attacked Hawaii, but at the same time, as part of the same attack, attacked and then quickly conquered the Philippines, attacked and quickly conquered Guam, attacked and quickly conquered Wake Island, and then a little later actually managed to conquer the western tip of Alaska. That war, that side of the war, which is so rarely talked about in the United States, was absolutely brutal. It was the bloodiest thing that ever happened on U.S. soil. We think the fighting in the Philippines killed somewhere in the order of 1.5 million people, more than a million of whom were Filipinos. Some of them died from, or a good number of them died from friendly fire, from the United States reconquering its own territory. And that event, World War II in the Philippines, that's the bloodiest thing that's ever happened on U.S. soil. That's about equivalent to two civil wars. So this notion of the United States as uniquely privileged and uniquely untouched, at least territorially, physically by the war, that depends on an understanding of where the United States is that's actually in, contradicts the actual borders of the country.
Well, indeed, in World War II, when the U.S. retook Manila, it was a very, very bloody battle, and an awful lot of civilians died.
Yeah, in about a month of fighting, we think that 100,000 people died. That's one-tenth of the population of Manila. And Manila was, at that point, this is really important to understand, the sixth largest city in the United States. It's a major U.S. city, often not understood as such because it's in the Philippines and not in, for example, Pennsylvania. But it was absolutely devastating to Manila, and you know, it took quite a lot to recover from that.
So, again, getting back to the idea that we have it both ways. We are both an empire and a republic, but at the same time, and notwithstanding the tensions between those two and the inconsistencies between those two, we also don't see ourselves as an empire. We see ourselves mostly as a sort of guardians of peace and democracy around the world. So how do the rest of the world see us, particularly our former colonies like the Philippines?
I think it's mixed, and I wouldn't speak for Filipinos, but I think there are some who view the connection with the United States as something to be quite proud of and something, you know, a sort of relationship to affirm. And there are others who are quite bitter about the way in which the United States colonized the Philippines, and especially in World War II, sort of, you know, failed to defend it and left it out for dry. But it's not just the Filipinos, or not just Filipinos who have that kind of ambiguous and ambivalent relationship with the United States, because of its, you know, great many military bases, a lot of people all over the world have had to think about their relationship with the territory of the United States, even if they haven't been colonized or occupied by the United States, as many people have or many places have. They've at least had to deal with the implantation of U.S. territory near them or in their country. So that kind of ambivalence, and the diversity of opinion, you can see not just in former colonies, but all over the planet.
Well, but the Filipinos did kick the U.S. out of these big bases like Subic Bay. And now you've got the Filipino president, who was a complete thug and a criminal, cozying up to the Chinese. God knows how much money he's taking out of the table. So things have changed.
Sure. The Philippine decision to, force the United States to remove its military bases from the Philippines, that's part of a larger wave of countries refusing entry to the U.S. bases or refusing U.S. troops entry that you can see, you know, through the 90s and 2000s and after. Overall, the trend is toward more and more countries refusing the United States to allow its military bases there. And you're right about Duterte. I mean, his politics about this are very much an anti-imperial politics, and his willingness to oppose the United States has, you know, been one of the sources of his popularity.
Well, Daniel Immerwahr, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I may speak with Daniel Immerwahr, who's a professor of history at Northwestern University and the author of Thinking Small, The United States and the Lure of Community Development. He has written for Slate and Dissent, among other publications, and his latest book just out is How to Hide an Empire, A History of the Greater United States. We're going to take a brief station break and back discussing whether there is a move underway to protect the Republican Party from the damage the revelations of the Mueller report could inflict on the GOP.
This is a war we can win. After 10,000 years, it's still us against them, and my heroes have always died at the end. So who's going to account for these sins?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Jeremy Vanuk, who is a research analyst for the Moscow Project at the Center for American Progress. He previously worked as an editorial fellow at The Atlantic, where he wrote extensively about President Donald Trump's conflicts of interest. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeremy Vanuk.
Thank you for having me.
So, Jeremy, what do you make of the announcement or the press reports that the Mueller inquiry is wrapping up, and we may even have an announcement next week that has gone to the Congress, obviously not to the American people, and we don't know what form it would go to the Congress in. But a lot of analysts I've talked to say it doesn't make sense. There's terabytes worth of information that came out of the recent FBI raid on Roger Stone. So a lot of people don't think it's really finished. So what could be going on here? I mean, could William Barr have basically told Mueller, because remember, Whitaker said that it was close to being finished. Could they basically say it's over, finished, you know, just hand it in? And what do you think's going on here? Because there's a bit of a disconnect between what still looks like more inquiries at the same time, this idea that we're going to, it's all over sometime next week.
That is certainly a possibility, what you said, that perhaps the former acting attorney general, Matt Whitaker, or the new attorney general, William Barr, may have put pressure on Mueller to wrap it up, to release a report in some form. And like you said, there are lots of unanswered questions that remain. We still, for example, don't know who directed Roger Stone to reach out to WikiLeaks on behalf of the Trump campaign, or who directed that person to reach out to Roger Stone to set up his back channel to WikiLeaks. We don't know what Michael Flynn talked about in his more than 60 hours of proffer sessions with Mueller and his investigators. But something that's important to remember is that the end of this phase of the Mueller investigation won't mean the end of the Russia investigation in any way. There are still almost certainly months of legal battles remaining. There could still be multiple more indictments coming out of Mueller's office, and that would still be consistent with the idea that the investigation phase of the Mueller probe is over. There will almost certainly be some sort of battle, legal battle, subpoenas, if William Barr does decide, and it is theoretically within his purview as Attorney General, to say that he does not believe that the report should be released to the American people. Now, I think that that would almost certainly be challenged, and I would be shocked if we are not, as the American people, able to see some form of the report that gets submitted to William Barr, to the Attorney General, which is theoretically what Mueller would be doing if, as people are predicting, he wraps up the investigation in the next week. But we are, at the very least, in for legal battles, in for continual revelations as we learn more about, for example, those terabytes of information that were taken from the raid on Roger Stone.
Well, is it possible, though, that a deal has been made where they basically told Mueller, you know, just release the report now, and but don't indict Trump's kids, which is Trump's red line? I mean, I'm suspicious of Barr because of he wrote that unsolicited 19-page memo, essentially auditioning for the job in the same way that Whitaker mm-hmm. auditioned for the job. And the fact that Whitaker made that announcement was very suspicious, which is almost like they're putting pressure on him either to wrap up or they've given him a deadline. So is it possible? I mean, what we forget about Mueller is that he's incredibly conservative, as is William Barr, although Mueller's reputation is sterling as a straight shooter. But he's nevertheless a very conservative guy. So is it possible that these two conservatives, the new attorney general and the special counsel, could basically decide for the good of the nation, in quotes, just to wrap this thing up?
There is always the possibility, as we've seen with the Trump administration again and again and again, that they are trying to keep as much information under wraps as they can. William Barr, as many people may remember, is the one who signed off on the pardons that ultimately ended the Iran-Contra scandal in 1992. But as we have seen over the last 2 years, as there have been repeated rumblings that Trump was planning to fire Robert Mueller, or he was planning to fire Jeff Sessions and install somebody who would then fire Robert Mueller, enacting basically a kind of slow motion Saturday Night Massacre as Richard Nixon did back in the 1970s. It's worth bearing in mind that Mueller has had a lot of time to prepare himself and his team for what may be the end game of his investigation. There have been multiple points at which there have been rumors that the investigation was about to end, whether because Mueller said so or because Trump was going to do something to put the kibosh on it. So I would be surprised if we don't find out that Mueller has enacted or plans to enact something that will ensure that what remains within his investigation that has not yet come out to the public does end up coming out to the public.
Well, what I'm getting at, though, Jeremy Vanook, is that these guys, both Mueller and Barr, are very, very conservative Republicans. And it's been puzzling all along why the Republican Party has gone along with Trump, particularly McConnell. Ryan did seem to do some kind of silent protest, but McConnell is a completely subordinated his constitutional duties to Trump. Now, the conventional wisdom is that Trump has 90% popularity amongst Republicans. So could the fix be in other words, to save the Republican Party? Because I believe, and you're a part of the Moscow Project, the Center for American Progress, I've talked to enough intel people who have been on the inside and have seen the evidence that this character, Donald Trump, is both a criminal and a traitor. And if it comes out that he is both, then the Republican Party is in terrible trouble, not to mention Mike Pence.
Mm-hmm. As I said, I would not be surprised to learn that there is some sort of plan in place by Trump, by Barr, by Matt Whitaker, who, according to the New York Times, actually characterized his job as to jump on a grenade for the president to make sure that he was in some way insulated from accountability for his actions. And you're right that I think that whatever the results of this are, we have already seen plenty of evidence that should be damning for the president, for the vice president, for members of their inner circle, and for the Republican Party. Going back now more than 2.5-3 years, we've seen a repeated pattern from Mitch McConnell, who effectively stopped the Obama administration from releasing a statement about Russian meddling during the 2016 election, and has again and again abdicated his responsibility to the American people to make sure that they are appraised of what is going on, and to make sure that people who may have sold out their country face accountability. We've seen Devin Nunes put in charge of an investigation. during which he effectively used his powers to run interference for the president. Richard Burr, who's been running the Senate investigation, isn't particularly better. He's been a little less public in his attempts to run interference for Trump, at least until the last couple weeks when he began saying, well, we've seen no direct evidence of collusion. We think there's plenty of direct evidence for collusion, from the back channel that they had through Roger Stone to WikiLeaks to Paul Manafort providing polling information to somebody that he and his business partners knew had ongoing ties to Russian intelligence. So I think that it's definitely a possibility that much of the Republican Party, as we know it today, as we see them acting over and over, are trying to make sure that the American public does not see the results of this investigation. Whether Mueller himself would be part of that, his reputation, as you said, is sterling. But I think that it's something that is definitely something everybody needs to consider, everybody should keep in mind about the possibility that an artificial end is being put onto this investigation from up top.
And again, I'm speaking with Jeremy Vanuk, who is a research analyst for the Moscow Project at the Center for American Progress. He previously worked as an editorial fellow at The Atlantic, where he wrote extensively about President Donald Trump's conflicts of interest. So the Moscow Project is sort of running in parallel, I guess, with Mueller. We know that in the last weeks, months, days of the Obama administration, they were frantically trying to disperse all the intelligence they had on Trump's collusion with the Russians into various parts of the government in a way that the Trump people couldn't bury them. So there's a lot of evidence that's been dispersed. I don't know what the fate of that evidence is. If you got every senior intelligence official just about in the country, including the most recent one, Andrew McCabe, saying that Trump could be a Russian asset. Before that, the Director of National Intelligence, General Clapper, said that Putin was Trump's case officer. The former head of the CIA, Brennan, has said that what Trump did in Helsinki at the press conference was close to treason. And he's even been more outspoken since then. And the former head of the National Security Agency and the CIA, General Hayden, has made similar remarks. So it's not like this is a big surprise. So where are you guys at with the Moscow Project? Have you come to the conclusion that Trump is both a criminal and a traitor?
Well, first off, I think that it's worth noting that you characterized a bunch of people who worked in the Obama administration as suggesting that Trump may be a Russian asset. But it's worth remembering that Kevin McCarthy, now the House Minority Leader, said in a closed-door meeting in 2016 that he believes that Trump is being paid off by Putin. He said Trump and Dana Rohrabacher, who recently lost his election for a congressional seat in California. Now, McCarthy claims that that was a joke, but the way that they made sure that it didn't leave the room until more than a year afterwards, the fact that Paul Ryan kind of immediately tried to hush that up, and the fact that they denied that such a conversation ever took place when the Washington Post first reported on it is pretty strong evidence that it may have been less of a joke than he wants us to think. In terms of whether President Trump has sold out his country, we think that there is a very damning pattern of evidence. We've identified lots and lots of ways. We have a list of 12 different ways that we think that Trump has been delivering on some of Putin's top foreign policy goals, from undermining NATO and the European Union to repeatedly suggesting that he may recognize Russia's illegal annexation of Crimea, which is something that prompted the sanctions on Russia that remain a thorn in Putin's side to this day, to simply saying that he would consider lifting sanctions on Russia. And it's hard to imagine why Trump would be so consistent on this of all things. He has flip-flopped on pretty much every issue imaginable, except his deference to Vladimir Putin. And knowing his decades of business interactions with Russian oligarchs, the fact that there were more than 100 meetings between members of his campaign and people affiliated with the Kremlin, including some who are high-ranking members of the Russian government, who are intelligence operatives, we think that it's hard to write off that pattern of behavior and come to the conclusion that Trump is anything other than a potential Russian asset who should be investigated as such.
Well, you know, it's pretty clear, and there's been recent evidence. McCabe, for example, talking about the FBI briefers when they told Trump about what's really going on in North Korea, and Trump said, no, I don't believe you guys. I believe what Putin told me. It's pretty clear that Trump believes the intelligence from Putin, but not from his own intelligence briefings, and he doesn't take intelligence briefings anymore. So that's never happened. Mm-hmm. You know, the whole...
And that's not the... That's obviously not the only instance of Trump siding with Putin over the U.S. intelligence community. The U.S. intelligence community has been saying since late 2016 that Russia tried to interfere in the 2016 election. And it seems like every chance he gets, Trump goes back and forth on whether or not he believes the U.S. intelligence community, most famously in Helsinki, when he stood right next to Vladimir Putin and had the opportunity to do what he's done with leaders of Germany, the UK, all of the countries that are supposedly our closest allies, and confront Putin. And instead what he did was he said, I have no reason to not believe Putin when he says that Russia did not try to hack the 2016 election.
Hmm. Well, yesterday Putin did his State of the Nation address where he was talking about these new sort of Buck Rogers Russian nukes that he claims they have will be targeted against American decision makers. But then he more or less hedged and said nice things about Donald Trump, but it suggested that Donald Trump is being manipulated or squeezed by the so-called deep state, which is what they say on Fox News all the time. So we have an extraordinary situation now where Fox News and Vladimir Putin are parroting the same line. Of course, I've always said that Fox News is the Pravda of the Republican Party, but this time they are also the Pravda of the Putin Party or United Russia. So this is an amazing situation. Just in closing, when are you going to have your report come out? And what kind of impact is it going to have on the people inside the Fox bubble?
I mean, we have been continuing to provide what we think is some of the best analysis out there of the Russia scandal, basically, since before the Mueller investigation began. We think that it's hard to imagine that whatever Mueller does end up producing will be anything other than damaging for Trump, given how much we've already seen that is damaging for Trump. As to whether or not it pierces the Fox News bubble, that's anybody's guess. I think that they have a lot of experience and motivated reasoning, a lot of experience in making things that shouldn't be scandals into scandals, and then making things that should be into what they term nothing burgers. But we are entering what's going to be basically a two-year-long presidential campaign, and it will almost certainly come up over and over and over again. And it will be on Democrats and on especially the Democrats who are running for president to pierce that bubble and to make the case to the American public that the Russia scandal is something that they should care about, and that a compromised president who may in fact be an asset of a hostile foreign power is one of the biggest national security threats that the United States has faced in a long time.
Well, Jeremy Vanook, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Jeremy. Jeremy Vanook, who is a research analyst for the Moscow Project at the Center for American Progress. He previously worked as an editorial fellow at The Atlantic, where he wrote extensively about President Donald Trump's conflicts of interest. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now. Lady dressed in white with the man she loved, standing along the side of the pickup truck. A shot bang out in the night, just when everything seemed right. Another headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305 took the kids to the park and disappeared by